Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from the club's offices overlooking San Francisco's Market Street. I'm Gloria Duffy, CEO of the Commonwealth Club, and your chair today. Before beginning our program, I want to extend a special welcome to the listeners of Moscow, Idaho, listening to this program on KPBX-FM in Spokane, Washington, one of more than 225 radio stations nationwide, carrying America's longest-running radio program. And now, on to our program for this evening. For the past few months, the Russian conflict with Chechenian rebels has followed on the heels of the Kosovo story as the lead international news item. We've seen the same kind of photos in the media, pitched battles in the streets, ragged refugees fleeing for their lives. This week, the Russian government seems to be in a final conflict, driving the Chechenian leaders out of Grozny into the countryside. The U.S. and Russia have disagreed violently about the Chechenian war, and we're here tonight to look deeper into what is going on in Chechnya and to try to sort out and analyze the differing U.S. and Russian views. What's really going on in Chechnya? What's the conflict about? Who are the Chechenian rebels? Are the Russians justified in their actions? Are the means they're using appropriate? Is the current Russian military action politically motivated? Will the rebels be back as they were after the last final assault on Grozny in 1996? Has U.S. policy been adequate to deal with the crisis? To help us understand the situation and the differing points of view, we are very fortunate to have two very knowledgeable and experienced diplomats with us this evening, one Russian and one American. Let me first introduce the Honorable Yuri Popov, Consul General of the Russian Federation for the Western United States, who is based here in San Francisco. Mr. Popov has had a distinguished career in the Russian Foreign Service, having served twice in Finland and as a secretary in the Executive Secretariat of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Moscow. He's a graduate of the Moscow Diplomatic Academy. Ambassador Tom Simons is currently a distinguished visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution and a consulting professor at Stanford University. Prior to that, he served as U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, as coordinator of U.S. assistance programs in the new independent states of the former Soviet Union, and as U.S. ambassador to Poland. Welcome, Yuri and Tom. And let's begin by asking Yuri Popov to describe for us the Russian concerns and objectives in dealing with Chechnya.
Well, thank you, Gloria, very much. It's a pleasure and honor for me to speak here in Commonwealth Club. And thank you, by the way, for the compliments. I like compliments, especially concerning my distinguished career. I mean, my post in San Francisco, of course. I think it's almost impossible to describe the situation, the facts, the history, prehistory of the Chechnya situation, but I'll try just to maybe say some, share some thoughts, ideas, data with you, and we'll have, just as Gloria told us, a possibility to exchange views in our discussion. So, for the beginning, I'll say that in accordance with the Constitution of Russian Federation, in force, the Chechen Republic is one of the 89th entities of the Federation. By the end of the 90s, due to the activities of Chechen authorities, the Republic's economy was all but totally destroyed. Before October 1991, the actual date of Dudaev's rise to power, Chechnya population was over 1 million persons. Slightly more than 700,000 Chechens and 200, 30,000 Russians. In September 1999, the Chechen population of Chechnya was about 650,000, but due for some social, economic, and other reasons, about 50% of the Chechen inhabitants were practically permanently residing beyond the Republic's territory. It means that almost 350 Chechens were actually living in Chechen Republic. And the diaspora, the Chechen diaspora in other regions of Russia, reaches today 500,000, 500,000 persons, including 250,000 in Moscow. Russian population in Chechnya today is no more than 20,000 persons, so it has reduced 10 times as compared to 1991. The prime cause of Chechen tragedy was the seizure of power by the regime of Jahar Dudayev. In August 91, he seized the premises of the Republican TV center in Grozny, the capital of Chechnya, as well as of Supreme Soviet, the Parliament of Chechnya, and the Council of Ministers. In October 91, Dudayev, in violation of the Russian Constitution, which was in effect at that time, held illegitimate, in the conditions of a coup d'etat, elections of the President and the Supreme Soviet and Parliament of the so-called Chechen Republic of Ichkeria. On personal orders of Dudayev, his supporters erect in 93 the referendum on status of the Chechen Republic within the Russian Federation. Dudayev also created in Chechnya illegal military units, acquiring arms and ammunition for them in a criminal way, though, in accordance with the Russian Constitution, the creation of armed forces is an exclusive prerogative of the Russian Federation. In December 1994, Dudayev, using such units, organized resistance to the federal forces who were restoring constitutional order in the Chechen Republic. The conclusion on August 31st in 96 of the Khasavyurt agreements and the election in February 97 Maschadov as president of the Chechen Republic opened up an opportunity to form a legal basis for relations between Russian Federation and its constituent entity Chechnya and to restore law and order in the Republic. And the federal authorities were ready to seize this opportunity in spite of the doubtful legitimacy of Aslan Maschadov, who had not been elected in accordance with the Russian law. However, instead of directing the emerging process of crisis settlement into a constitutional channel, the authorities of the Chechen Republic preferred to take a different course. The Republic turned into an enclave managed by terrorists and drug and arms traffickers. The Sharia law was introduced in the Republic in February last year by Maschadov decrees. The Sharia norms are reverting modern society to the system of barbaric penalties, such as mutilation by cutting fingers and limbs, even for minor crimes, which, for example, violates not only the European Convention on Human Rights, but also European Convention on the Prevention of Torture and Degrading Treatment. Taking hostages, including foreign nationals, has become a policy of the criminal Chechen authorities. By the end of 1999, the number of hostages has totaled 500 persons. It's only according to Ministry of the Interior of Russian Federation, its official figure, but I presume it could be more. In 1991, 1999, 46,000 people were abducted and enslaved, and 62 gangs, numbering about almost 3,000 members, were engaged in this business. Along with crimes against the person, the illegal armed groups committed a number of economic crimes, including production and circulation, for example, of counterfeit U.S. dollars. According to available information, it's official information, they were fabricated both in two cities of Chechen Republic, in the cities of Argun and Grozny. The Chechen territory has also become a criminal zone of industrial production of drugs. So far, at least three heroin-producing factories have been identified in Grozny, in Shali, and just near Shali, the third one. And Chechnya has also become a channel of drug transit. The beginning of modern crisis was the 1st of August of 1999, when illegal armed groups led by Shamil Basayev and Khattab raised an armed revolt against the legal government in Dagestan, a neighboring republic of the Russian Federation, constituted entity. On August 10th, the so-called Islamic Shura, a kind of a parliament, declared the secession of Dagestan from Russia and beginning of a holy war against invaders, Russians. The Shura also adopted an appeal to Islamic Chechen state, a state and people, calling for support to the Muslims of Dagestan. And Basayev became an official head of the armed forces of the Islamic Shura. The mutiny of Chechen terrorists was suppressed by vigorous actions of federal forces with the support of local residents, who formed a 25,000-strong volunteer corps. That's only volunteers. And the authorities of Dagestan. I won't speak about the acts of terrorism organized and carried out by Chechens outside Chechen Republic. I mean in Moscow, the explosions of apartment houses in autumn of 99, in Moscow, in Volgodonsk, its Rostov region, the southern part of Russia, and Buynaksk in Dagestan. And the facts established by the criminal proceeding instituted in connection with those explosions testify to the involvement of the so-called field commanders of the illegal armed forces in the territory of Chechen Republic, primarily Basayev, Raduyev, and Khattab. During the whole period since the signing of the Khasavyurt agreements in 96, the federal authorities patiently worked for its implementation, looked for every opportunity to restore law and order in Chechen Republic by peaceful means. For example, in 1997, President of Russian Federation Boris Yeltsin met with Aslan Maskhadov in Moscow. In 1998, the head of Russian government, Yevgeny Primakov, met with Maskhadov in Vladikavkaz. And Maskhadov was repeatedly invited to dissociate himself from criminal structures and terrorist elements to take steps to stop their illegal activities. But the situation in Chechnya continued to deteriorate, maybe because Maskhadov was unable or unwilling to do so. So the anti-terrorist operation of the federal forces in Chechnya began immediately after the attack by armed groups on the neighboring constituent entity of Russian Federation, the Republic of Dagestan. On December 13th, the State Duma of Federal Assembly of Russian Federation adopted a resolution on amnesty for persons who committed socially dangerous acts in the course of the anti-terrorist operation, giving opportunity for those terrorists to stop their activities. As a result of the operation, a considerable part of the territory of Chechnya, almost 80%, by now was cleared, is cleared of bandit groups, and we hope that the military stage of the operation is drawing to a close to be followed by political settlement. on the basis of strict respect for the constitution of Russian Federation. The federal troops in Chechnya are not confronted by separate terrorist groups, but by a well-armed and trained army of some 25,000 men, 25,000, including almost 2,000 foreign mercenaries. It's official information. Well-equipped and having all kind of high-tech communication systems and so forth. The federal forces are undertaking all necessary measures to liberate human settlements without assaults or other massive actions, with no casualties or destructions, and on the basis of agreements with population representatives. That is how, for example, 4 or 5 cities or over half of 120 human settlements were liberated, including such cities, the main cities as Gudermes and Achoy Martan. So, unfortunately, in conducting a military operation of such a scale, casualties among the civilian population cannot be fully avoided. This, incidentally, is the goal of the militants' tactics who deploy heavy armaments within human settlements, quite often near kindergartens, schools, and hospitals. But the actual civilian casualties are nevertheless not massive, and all possible measures are taken to reduce them to a minimum. In difficult cases, so I think the federal troops display patience and restraint. As of December 1999, 267,000 people from Chechen Republic were registered as refugees. But despite the difficult humanitarian situation, there is no humanitarian catastrophe or disaster in the region. And I can quote Mrs. Sadako Agata, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, who visited the region and was, I cannot say quite satisfied by the situation, but who stated that there is no a kind of humanitarian disaster. In the liberated areas of the Chechen Republic, measures to ensure law and order are taken immediately. Acting Attorney General of the Chechen Republic was appointed in November 1999, and development of the work of prosecution bodies was ensured. Once the personnel are selected, heads of district administration and settlements are appointed forthwith from among local residents. Upon decision by the government of Russia, more than 100 million rubles of budget appropriation have been allocated for the restoration of the social and economic infrastructure. And this year, the government has allocated 3 billion rubles for restoration in Chechnya. So we can say that peaceful life is restored or being restored in the Chechen settlements liberated from bandits. Schools are open again. I can say that In Chechnya, there were no school practically for the last 5-6 years. The heat supply is being restored, so on and so forth. In dealing with humanitarian situation in the Northern Caucasus, in Chechnya, including the Russian government demonstrates openness for dialogue with international organizations. For example, 9 international delegations visited the region from October to December last year, including, as I told you, United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Sadako Agata, the Commissioner for Human Rights of the Council of Europe, Hilary Bless, and the OSCE Chairman in Office, Knut Vollebæk. At present, the International Red Cross Committee, the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Christian Societies, together with the Russian Red Cross, are implementing programs of humanitarian medical assistance. We hope that the large-scale anti-terrorist part of the operation of federal forces will be completed in the nearest future. And after that, the so-called anti-terrorist activities will proceed in a regular terrorism control fashion, accepted all over the world. Then we plan to hold the elections in a democratic atmosphere to replace the appointed authorities with elected ones. And the elections will be followed by talks with the newly elected government of Chechnya on the status of the republic within the Russian Federation. So what I want to say more, that I don't like to speak about the operation in Chechnya as only military, because it's only a part of dealing with terrorists, but Russian government of Russian Federation, had at least three goals: political one, political settlement in the republic, economic, restoring the normal economy of the Republic of Chechnya, and social, restoring normal life of the Chechens in Chechnya Republic. So that's maybe, is it all? Thank you, just for the beginning.
Thank you very much, Consul General Popov. Now Ambassador Simons.
Gloria, Yuri Vladimirovich, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be here speaking to this distinguished audience. I would like to try to lift us maybe a little bit out of the blood and guts of what's going on in Chechnya, which, of course, is fascinating and absorbing, but very difficult to follow. Because there's a war going on and there's a lot of disinformation on both sides. And not to speak for the U.S. government, because I can't do that anymore, and it's such a relief. Because now, as John Kenneth Galbraith once looked at a bunch of us Foreign Service officers and said, you will be amazed at how refreshing it is after you retire to be able finally to speak the truth, as the Consul General will discover upon his retirement also. So I would like to, and the U.S. government, but the U.S. government, like American people, is clearly caught between conflicting feelings and desires when it comes to Chechnya. Of course, we're afraid about, we're appalled at what's going on in this awful war, and of course, we're afraid about the effects of this awful war on Russia. I mean, every candidate, I mean, from both parties in this, I won't say awful campaign, but every candidate agrees that, you know, our big foreign policy problems as we go into this new century are going to continue to be Russia and China. And so it's good that we worry about the effects on Russia. Russia is important to America. There are lots of things we want to do with Russia. We want to do nuclear arms reduction, but there are lots and lots of other things. We just hosted a meeting on the Middle East in Moscow, for instance. When I was in Pakistan, when I was ambassador to Pakistan and dealt with Afghanistan, because we have no representation in the country, despite all our enmity with Russia during the Afghanistan war, we were very much on the same wavelength, very much on the same wavelength. We were against terrorism. We're against radicalism, wearing religious clothes. We're for international standards of human rights. We're for political reconciliation in a situation like that. Conversely, there are lots of things that we don't want to do against Russia. We don't want to put sanctions on Russia. We don't want to reestablish policies of exclusion of Russia. We don't want to return to a military buildup that's sort of driven by fear of Russia. And we know that returning to these bad things is going to be costly to us as well as costly to Russia. So we want to do the good things with Russia, and we don't want to do the bad things against Russia. The Chechen war, the war in Chechnya, is making it harder to do that. It's making it harder to do that. The worst thing about the way the war in Chechnya is going is that it is convincing the American public and therefore the American electorate and therefore the American government, not always immediately, but that's the powder chain, convincing us to think of Russia not as a partner and a possible friend, but once again as an enemy. And we worry a lot about Russia, about what Russians think of us. And that's proper. Russia is going through hard times. They like to blame the outside world for everything. They like to blame us, first of all. The Consul General has refrained from doing that, but that's because he's such an accomplished diplomat.
I had no time.
No, he didn't have time to get into that. So we worry about what the Russians think of us. I worry that the Russians don't seem to be worrying enough about what we think of them, and that can be very dangerous. I'd like to throw in here a little personal story. 24 years ago, in 1976, I was a middle-level official at the American Embassy in Moscow. The Consul General is a senior official here in San Francisco. I was just middle level. And I had a Soviet friend who has remained a friend. He happened to be an expert on Afghanistan, and he happened to have the same first name and patronymic as the Consul General. It was years before the invasion of Afghanistan. We generally talked about Asian Muslim things, but he knew a lot about the Third World. 2 years before the invasion of Afghanistan, but just 2 years after Watergate, and just a year after we'd been thrown out of Vietnam. And at that point, the Soviets were funding Cuban troops in Angola and in Eritrea, and they were fomenting new revolutions in Central America. Now, in the early 70s, we'd done détente together, and I was a big supporter of détente. But Kissinger, in the fall of 1975, after they flew and funded Cuban troops in Angola, had warned them that détente's not going to survive if you keep doing this. Détente can't survive politically. We're going to lose arms control. But they thought they were on a roll. They thought the world correlation of forces was shifting. They thought we were on the run. I mean, it's hard to blame them, except they were terribly wrong. So I said to my friend, I said, Yuri Vladimirovich, we Americans learned a lesson in Vietnam about the limits of our power. And aren't you afraid that by acting the way you're acting in the world, you can teach us to unlearn that lesson? Because if you keep it up, you can convince us, again, that you're not partners for us, but enemies. And then we're going to go after you again. Well, that's what we were telling the Soviets, but they weren't listening. They couldn't listen at that point. They didn't feel they needed to listen. They didn't feel they needed to worry about what we were thinking. And so what they stood on was the legal ground. They told us that they had never made any agreements not to support these national liberation movements, these socialist and progressive forces in the world, and therefore they didn't have to listen to us. We didn't have anything to say about it. They said, we have the right to do what we're doing, and you don't have anything to say about it. Moreover, history's on our side. We could argue about that. But mainly, we have the right to do what we're doing, so butt out. And they kept it up. They kept it up. We tried to keep détente up. I mean, the Carter administration signed SALT II, the second Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, in 1978. But we also started a hedge. I mean, it was in 1978 that our defense spending started to go up again after the 3 years of downturn after Vietnam. And still the Soviets kept it up. And in 1979, very much against the advice of my friend, I must say, they invaded Afghanistan. And Carter then put SALT II on ice. And 1980, 4 years after I'd talked to my friend, We had an administration that defined the Soviet Union as an evil empire. And we started rolling out the heavy artillery again, the economic artillery, the military artillery, and the political artillery. Now, since 1985, that's just 15 years ago, since 1985, when Mikhail Sergeyevich Gorbachev became General Secretary, the Soviet Union and then Russia under Boris Nikolaevich Yeltsin have made huge progress in getting rid of that enemy image that Americans had of the Soviet Union and then of Russia. And now I'm afraid that the war in Chechnya is going to throw that machine into reverse again. Russia today is, of course, more democratic than the Soviet Union was then, and we do more things together. I mean, we're in peacekeeping in Bosnia. We have lots of things we do together. We had a tremendous, the first time the Security Council ever did a Security Council resolution against terrorism. It was U.S. It was Afghanistan. It was U.S. and Soviet co-sponsorship. Russia today is clearly trying to listen to the outside world more than the Soviet Union ever did. I mean, Mr. Putin was with Secretary Albright. You have all the visits that the Consul General told us about. You have OSCE observers on the border between Chechnya, the Russian Federation, and Chechnya, and Georgia next door. The European Union chairman visits. There are journalists. There are journalists on the scene, foreign journalists. Now, of course, that means they get arrested. But it may also, let us hope, mean that they get released. We're going to have questions about Mr. Babitsky, I'm sure. But when I watch the Russian government's reaction to American dismay and American shock about Chechnya, I am still reminded of that time just before detente went into reverse in the late 1970s. When Madeleine Albright warns the Russians about the war in Chechnya is increasing their international isolation, her good friend, that's what they call each other, Igor Ivanov, the foreign minister, says, well, if there is any isolation, it'll go away soon. Hey. We're told that Chechnya, just as they're standing on legal ground, and you heard the consul general do it, Chechnya is Russian sovereign territory, so Russia can do anything it wants there, and the outside world has nothing to say about it. What Russia can do, because it's Russian sovereign, and it's all anti-terrorist. Everything is anti-terrorist. All the resistance in Chechnya is terrorist. And that means that you can declare every male between 11 and 60 as a non-civilian to be a terrorist. You can do that, and the outside world has nothing to say about it. Everything is legal. Everything is going forward under Russian law, and so the U.S. has nothing to say about it. And I'm afraid that Americans, if they keep hearing that, are going to become more and more convinced that the Russians don't care what we think. And we're going to start thinking that if they can do that to their own people, because these Chechens are Russian citizens, if they can do that to their own people, what won't they do to their neighbors if they feel they have the right to do it? And they can do it to anyone else if they feel they have the right to do it. And at that point, as in the late 70s, they're going to cease to be potential partners and potential friends, and they're going to become potential aggressors and enemies again. Because Americans still march to the battle hymn of the Republic. And they still march to the battle hymn of the Republic. He's calling down the lightning of his terrible swift sword. Now, the truth is that these days, that sword is not very swift. It takes a long time to take it out of its sheath. But once you do it, it's really hard to get it back in. And that, I think, is the stake of the war in Chechnya.
Well, thank you very much, Tom Simons and Yuri, both, for your frank discussions now. We have a lot of questions. The first one we're going to start with has to do with the relationship of the Chechen rebels to Muslim extremists. And there were four or five questions on this topic. What connection, what ties do the Chechen rebels have to other Muslim extremist groups, the Taliban in particular? And in fact, isn't there a need to address this problem at an international level, since it is a part of a menace being spread by Islamic fundamentalists from different countries? I'll put that to either or both, Yuri and Tom.
Yeah, it is a problem. The problem of radicalism in Islamic countries, which takes on religious form, which puts out a religious ideology in order to explain and drive radicalism, is a major international problem, and it also affects Chechnya. I mean, the Taliban, with whom I've spent a lot of time and watched a lot in Afghanistan, have announced that they're helping the rebels in Chechnya. They say they don't have much money, they don't have any resources, but the lads are kind of on their way. Then you get a report that there's some of them already there. You know, they're in with the insurgent forces in Chechnya. So it is a problem. You have a UN security resolution designed to deal with it. You're getting increased cooperation, international cooperation among legal authorities, police authorities to try to deal with it. No doubt about it, but it has to be said that it's not the root of the problem in Chechnya.
Yuri?
I would like just to add that the Taliban movement, I don't know whether it's movement or how we call it, is maybe the only one official or unofficial entity who established a kind of diplomatic relations with Chechen. I don't like to call them rebels. I also don't like the word terrorists, but they are really bandits, terrorists, and according to the way they ruled this country, this small Northern Caucasus country for last 8 years. So that's the only one example of their relations with Muslim radicals. But I would like to say, to state that that's not the military operation against Islam, and Chechnya is an Islamic, the Chechen people, they are, well, Islamists, positively, and that's not an action against the Islam in Chechnya, but against those bandits and terrorists.
Thank you. Now, there was a whole other set of questions which have to do with why shouldn't Chechnya be able to secede? Why can't it be a separate country? Going back to the time the Russian Federation was formed and the Soviet Union broke up, why didn't Chechnya become an independent country as, for example, Belarus and Ukraine? Can you help us to understand the criteria for determining republics are independent and which are not?
We should have asked Dzhokhar Dudayev when I told you that in 1993, that was after the collapse of Soviet Union, but he didn't allow the referendum on Chechnya situation, on Chechnya position in Russian Federation.
But were there other autonomous regions in the Russian Federation or others of these 89 subunits who had such referenda or who worked out sort of special arrangements with the central federal authorities? I think there were. I think Tatarstan has it.
Practically all the so-called subject or entities, the members of the Federation, 89, except Chechnya, they have all kind of the kind of agreements considering the relations between those subjects, those entities, and federal authorities, and a kind of a distribution of authority between, between Moscow and those entities.
Yeah. And they were the only ones who refused that.
Chechnya. Well, Dudaev, yeah. Yes.
If Putin wins in March, do you expect his use of military force to increase or decrease in Chechnya and elsewhere?
That's a good question. Shall we start discussing the perspective of presidential elections in Russia?
Well, relates to this question.
I hope that I would like to state once more that the activities in Chechnya, the federal activities in Chechnya, is not only military, but military operation, which will become a police operation, and I hope it will become very soon after, I don't know, it's not a question of months, but maybe weeks, or I hope days, but not only police activities, but police operation, but also political, economical, and social.
If I could, just a fact, because I've been boning up. In the polls, the number of, for what they're worth, public opinion polls in Russia, the percentage of people who want the next president to bring Chechnya to a peaceful conclusion has now passed over 50%.
Uh-huh. It's natural. And the situation, if we speak about polls, the Russian, it's not the problem of Russians saying pro or contra this military operation in Chechnya, a part of peaceful settlement, of normal settlement in Chechnya, but of its desire of Russian people, citizens of Russian Federation, to stop this development, the development of this terrorist state. Well, again, terrorist. I'm sorry, Thomas.
Let's concede for a moment that it is a terrorist state, that there's support from Islamic fundamentalists, that there's drug trade and so on going on. Mm-hmm. But let's talk for a moment about the appropriateness of the methods being used to that threat and that situation. The type of major military action. Is this really the way to deal with a terrorist threat? And I ask this in part because I was at a U.S.-Russian conference recently where there was a discussion of how perhaps the U.S. might have become involved in helping or advising Russia if specific targeted anti-terrorist methods were being used instead of major military attack. What about the appropriateness of the methods?
It's a very...
Either one.
At least according to Alphabet. Am I the first?
Yes, you are, as a matter of fact.
Even in the Cyrillic alphabet.
Well, I think that it's very difficult to speak about a kind of appropriate measures against terrorists, especially in this particular case in Chechnya. As I told you, practically, they are not. It's not terrorists or bandits just somewhere in the streets, but the federal, our military state now that we deal with a very well equipped, a very well prepared army, 25,000, and those military measures are waged against this army, not against the people in Chechnya. Though it's a tragedy, of course, all kind of such military operations, especially when it is waged in the cities or in some rural settlements, Of course, we cannot avoid casualties, but I think that this restraint and the deal against the terrorists, that's the main way of behavior of federal forces.
Tom?
I think it's also true that an ongoing war increases radicalism and increases insurgency. I mean, you know, and I think that these phenomena were probably smaller at the outset. And I was impressed with the testimony a couple of days ago of a former Russian prime minister last summer, Stepashin. He was actually a former interior minister before he became prime minister, and who invoked the testimony of a number of other Russian prime ministers who said that they were planning an operation which would have involved military forces in the northern part of the country down to the Terek River and sealing the border with Dagestan to prevent the kind of incursions last summer of these terrorists and radicals that went into Dagestan, and which was the immediate spark, but down to that river and sort of standing there and trying to be political after that. He said that four prime ministers, including himself, gave that advice to, I think, the new prime minister, Putin, who's now the acting president and prime minister. And that was what the plan was, and it was rejected, and his assumption was that it was because the military wanted revenge for what it considered a defeat in 1996.
Well, there's a specific question for you, Tom. What is your greatest criticism of Russia's handling of Chechnya? Do you think they should have restrained themselves from all military action?
No, but I like the plan that Stepashin described. Now, it's been the reality of that plan has been denied by the official spokesman, I have to say that. And so my friend Yuri Vladimirovich, I think, will be bound by that. But I think it's impressive testimony that they had an alternative plan, and that sounded like a more productive way to go to me.
Yuri?
Well, I don't know about Mr. Stepashin's statement, or I've read his interview, and I think that at least the member of our general staff, Russian general staff, said that it was not true. And I don't know what was how the now acting president, Mr. Putin, would have got some advices from Prime Minister, because then he was Prime Minister Stepashin, I think so, last March. So.
One of our listeners raises a question about what proof there was that Chechens blew up the apartment buildings in Moscow last fall.
Well, I've seen the last facts about this, well, concerning those explosions in Moscow. The at least two or three terrorists were identified, and it's an official information that they were, after those explosions, they have come to Chechnya. We don't know where are they. But, for example, and we got a kind of information that they were just prepared in those military camps on the territory of Chechnya, of this Arab mercenary Khatab. And some, I think that was yesterday in Russian papers, and it's official information, maybe on briefing also, in Russian Information Center, that three guilty in explosions in Rostov region in Volgodonsk were also identified as those men who were prepared and those terrorists' institution in Chechnya?
As far as I have been able to determine, there is no solid proof that those bombings were carried out by Chechen, by people connected with the Chechen authorities. I don't know. I mean, and you have to be very careful about information of this sort because, as I say, there's a lot of disinformation and there is a war on.
Well, maybe someone knows the specific answer to this question.
I agree, and Tom is right, but that's, I think, if it's official information about those persons, at least, only five just identified as the parties of those terrorist acts in Moscow and Buynaks and in Volgodonsk. So it's official information.
Yuri, you mentioned the refugees. Is Russia taking steps to support surrounding states such as Georgia, et cetera, with the onslaught of Chechen refugees?
Georgia?
Well, the questioner may not know exactly where the refugees are, wherever they are.
Well, the problem is that Ingushetia, Ossetia, Alanya, and Dagestan. Also, as I say, as I told you, it was 260,000 refugees. But the problem is that the situation is being just under control, and practically 90,000 of those refugees already came back to their places of living, of origin, whatever it is, and the situation is being just dealt with by the Ministry of Emergency, by, as I said, Red Cross, and all kinds of humanitarian organizations.
I just wondered if you had a comment on that question about refugees.
No.
Okay. There are some questions about the aftermath of the war. One of them is, given what you know of the tenacity of guerrilla forces from our own Vietnam experience, what if the Russians cannot gain the upper hand, cannot win in Chechnya? How will Russians react?
I'm in bad position in comparison with Tom, because a diplomat, at least in such situation, doesn't like subjunctive mood in English. And as I said, and I would like to state once more, that the decision of Russian government is to transform military operation into police operation, and I hope that it would be possible, and of course that would be one of the difficulties of life in Chechen Republic after the conflict, but not the only one.
Let's get back for a moment to Tom Simon's points about the role of the Chechnya conflict in the U.S.-Russian relationship. The question is, at this stage in Russian development, is it more important for Russians to see themselves as strong victors over Chechnya versus Americans to see Russia as a friendly country? It seems that Russia should focus on making Russians feel good about their country so they'll have the strength to overcome corruption, mafia, bribery, etc., rather than worry about American opinion. Tom?
I think that's an excellent question, and it goes to the heart of what we have been talking about. And clearly Russians are going to do what is in their interest. And from my point of view, they need to be prouder. They need to have a more effective state. They've been through a hard time. It is a good thing for them to be proud of themselves and what they're doing in order to pursue these kinds of reforms. But it's very important, it seems to me, that they be proud of themselves for the right things. And they have spent too long, I think, under the Soviet Union, struggling to develop where what they were mainly proud of was their dominance over neighboring peoples. And I think to give them that to be proud of probably doesn't help. It hurts, in addition to what it does to the Americans. Because I think that we're in a position at the margin to help Russia become a more prosperous, democratic place. They're going to have to do it mainly themselves, but we can help. We can't help if it seems to us that they are reverting to dominion over others as the main reason why they're proud of themselves. That's the danger of Chechnya.
I'd like to ask one last question and put it to Yuri, if that's all right. And end on a positive note. What can Russia...
Was the whole discussion positive?
Yes, although of a difficult topic. What can Russia do in an attempt at rebuilding a living and working Chechnya?
Once more.
What can Russia do? What assistance can it provide it in rebuilding a living and working Chechnya?
And who else will, besides the Russian government?
Well, we would get to that if we had time.
As you know, as I told you, one of the main cities of Chechnya, Gudermes, was liberated, and there is a vice prime minister of Russian government, Koshman, working already in this Gudermes city, just dealing with this problem, with these issues of restoring the economy, the social infrastructure, cultural of infrastructure of Chechen's life. And as I told you, it's very problematic for Russia to get to finance this operation, the whole operation. And nonetheless, it's already, as I told you, $2 billion appropriation in the budget of year 2000. And they are going to restore the, is it oil wells in Chechnya, and get more money for this restoration of Chechnya economy. By the way, if we were speaking about economy of Chechnya, there were 700 oil wells in Chechnya, and last year only 5 of them were operating. 705. And this Vice Prime Minister Koshman stated that it's possible for him and for his team to restore at least 50 oil wells and to get some more, maybe $1.5 billion for this year, budget for restoration of Chechnya.
I would like to say thank you to our audience for excellent questions. Thank you to Ambassador Tom Simons of Stanford University, and thank you to Consul General Yuri Popov of the Russian Federation.
Thank you.
This meeting of the Commonwealth Club is now adjourned. Thank you. We're off the radio now, but Mr. Simons has one last comment.
I'd like you to join me in a special accolade for the Consul General, who came here in front of a skeptical audience in a language that is not his first language.
Thank you.
And who did a very good job.
Thank you very much. Thank you.